You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and my guest today is A.S. Byatt, the author of The Djinn in the Nightingale's Eye, published by Random House. She is the author as well. I'll just do the more recent works because she was really discovered in America with her book Possession. And she is the author as well of Angels and Insects. I can't tell you how many people talk to me about that film still. The Matisse stories, Babel Tower, and now The Djinn in the Nightingale's Eye. And I thought it would be wonderful to have her on during our subscription drive because these stories are at the essence of what we do on Bookworm. They are about the necessity for storytelling itself, whether that be for consolation, for joy, for recollection, for memory, for exploration. And I wanted to ask you about the significance of the fairy story to you.
I think the fairy story when I was a girl was a release. It gave another world in brighter colors in which everything that happened was important. And one of the things the fairy story was for me as a child across what, despite the war being on, seemed like acres of boredom. What it was kind of concentrated excitement and complete satisfaction at the end of it. I think now I'm grown up, it's the fairy story is still a kind of heightened imaginative world, but it doesn't now stand against boredom. It stands as a kind of a sensual distillation of what the nature of storytelling is all about. And people don't have characters in a fairy story. They just have a kind of elemental world, and then they have a fate which is worked out.
That element of boredom is very much a part of the story of the Five Called Dragon's Breath, where the people are so used to their daily grind and the quality of the rugs that they weave and the daily feeding of the animals and the shooting of the this and the that, that when the dragons wake up from the top of the hill and begin to slide down the grooves on the side of the mountain, they are figures at last for excitement. And the story is about the relationship in a way of imagination and destruction.
It was a very difficult story to write. It was commissioned by two Dutch women who were doing a kind of Scheherazade production for Bosnia, for Sarajevo. And they were reading stories in theatres all over Europe every night until the fighting stopped in Sarajevo. And I felt compelled to accept their invitation to write a story because it seemed to me an imaginative gesture towards Sarajevo. And B, I felt, what on earth can I write sitting in peaceful England about the extremity of experience they have and I haven't shared? And then I thought, well, what is my world? What is the relation in my world to extreme violence? And then I had this sense that everybody's world is actually threatened by the terrible, by the violent. Everybody who is not immediately threatened experiences the everyday as boring. And I do know enough about violence in my own life to know that about the only consolation of having gone through disaster and death and destruction is that afterwards what looked boring has this kind of glitter that fairy stories have of things being, after all, completely staggering that they exist at all. And so I wrote, you know, that the peasants who made these woolen rugs in these only had three colours. And the girl was bored to death with the three colours and thought she would go to the big city and get some more colours. When she came back and found that her house hadn't been burnt up or eaten up by the dragons as they passed by, was amazed how beautiful the colours were. And that was the only... I terribly also wanted to end on a positive note for Sarajevo, not write something horrible which wouldn't live up to the horror they were living through.
Now, The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye. It's a very interesting title in a certain way. It could have been called The Genie in the Lamp, which is really what it is. But what we have is a title that tells us that even in the imaginary world, there is more to be known and there is a way to be specific. And so a jinn is the Arabian Nights word for genie, and the nightingale's eye is a specific kind of glass that you saw at first in Istanbul and struck you as being the ideal home, yes, for a captured jinn.
I think that was true. Glass is one of my images for the imagination because you look at it and you look through it into some other world. And the other of my images for the imagination is spiral forms. And this glass has spiral forms of blue and white on glass. But I thought only as you spoke that, of course, the other thing about the nightingale's eye is that it's a kind of fusion of two imaginative worlds, because what the nightingale does is sing. And yet the glass is called after its looking. And so there is a terribly tight image for a whole world of the imagination with a bird, a voice, vision, spirals, something cold to touch, something transparent. And out of this comes the genie like a smoke. So it was almost irresistible, really.
Well, what's lovely about this is that the jinn in the nightingale's eye, its first two stories are drawn from the earlier novel Possession. But when you think about books of fairy stories, whether it's Under the Green Umbrella or the Yellow Book of Fairy Stories, they are drawn from other places, other cultures, other ways of imagining magic. And this book, too, is a kind of cross-cultural, cross-literary culmination, in a sense. It goes afterwards, you wrote Babel Tower, which has, you know, scenes from Hansel and Gretel in the form of candy people and extraordinary Dionysian activity. But this seems to be the preparation for a breakthrough, the Gin in the Nightingale's Eye.
It felt like a breakthrough. I didn't think about it too much because it was one of the things I've written with the most intense pleasure, I think, of many of my stories. And more than any of the other fairy stories, as you say, it is self-consciously a cultural object. It does its own thinking as it goes along, but it thinks entirely with storytelling. It doesn't think in abstract language. A good story should never point a moral. You can tack one on at the end, as Cyrano de Bergerac keeps doing. But a really good story always contains an awful lot more than what it appears to be doing.
It seems to me that along that line, abundance is the metaphor for fairy stories, that often as not, the structure is not only the magical bridge that allows you to cross it, but at the other end of the bridge, the cottage with food steaming and waiting for you. And not only that, but when you finish your meal and push aside the chairs, there will be voices to sing you to sleep or reveal the next side. So what you're talking about, I think, in fairy tales is that supercharge of always something more, certainly something more than just morals. And it seems to me that more than other stories, the supercharge in a fairy story is beauty.
Yes, beauty in a fairy story is like the perfection of the narrative. I mean, a fairy story is no good if it doesn't have an absolutely satisfying end, which is beautiful, in which all the things that have been started are resolved so that, I mean, your image of sitting down to a good meal is one of the resolutions. Another is the wedding where there is a feast. And very occasionally you get one of a tree blossoming out of a grave so that although somebody's dead, life goes on. The story has to be resolved, but the other aspect of abundance in fairy storytelling is the story within a story within a story within a story, which suggests eternity. If you read the Arabian Nights, and Scheherazade starts and she tells a story about somebody who doesn't finish his story but tells a story about somebody who tells a story about somebody, and then she throws all these golden balls in the air and juggles with them and brings them down in a perfect pattern. And I tried to do this a bit as well. And
it seems to me, really, that the essence of this kind of short story, the fairy story, is generosity. And as opposed to certain minimalists, it seems to me that your character as a writer is one of telling more and telling all and super adding rather than holding back or withdrawing. Could you speak about why?
I think I believe in generosity. I believe in largeness. And I do that because I've observed that the world is a better place to live in if the people you meet and the world you meet is like that. And you can almost, I remember almost making a conscious decision when I was a depressive person of about 21, that instead of feeling that everything was very grey and I was rather small, I would work on the assumption that everything was almost infinitely interesting and that I could do something with it. And the truth is, you can almost make a decision to do that, and everything is almost infinitely interesting. And I think I learned from both George Eliot and Iris Murdoch as storytellers that if you put a lot of people and a lot of different things into a story, the reader will know that these are only a very, very small selection of the even more different things and different ideas connected to these ones, which you could have put in. And a really good story does make the world charged with more light, more colour, more interest, more thoughts.
Now, you've taken some of these stories from the novel. Have you ever grown a novel from a story?
I used never to think of stories because in these small, grey, pinched days, anything I thought of I would write down in a notebook and wait to see if it turned into a novel, and the ones that didn't I simply discarded. Now I know I haven't got time in my life left to write even a few of the novels I've got in my head. So if I have an idea for a story, I leave it small like a story. And it is very, very gratifying because then, of course, it becomes overcharged. It gets all the things that you could have spread into a novel remain condensed into the small number of images of a story. It's like writing sonnets. It's a compressed form of intense pleasure.
Final question. Many fairy stories tell children, Bruno Bettelheim famously says, what it will be like to endure adult confrontations of various sorts. They're rehearsals, he says, for things that are inevitable in maturation. What thrilled me about The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye by my guest A.S. Byatt is that because these are stories for adults, they are yearnings to have things subtracted. And so the first of the wishes the djinn grants the young woman is to be a younger woman, is to have the body she had when she last liked her body. And I wanted to talk to you about fairy tales for adults as that process of subtraction and shrinking, which is the metaphor for the end of the story, The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye, things getting smaller and smaller and smaller and pared away.
I think getting smaller and pared away is an image for the good aspect of getting older. And on the whole, I enjoy getting older very much more now at 60 than I enjoyed getting older when I was 20, when I found it extremely frightening. And most of the confrontations Bettelheim talks about were still ahead. Whereas now I feel that an awful lot of the confrontations are gone, and what is left is some essence of life. And if I could just keep my body in enough order to enjoy this essence of life rather than collapsing on aeroplanes, it would all be perfect. So I have an image of the world what Gillian gets at the end of the Gin in the Nightingale's Eye are some perfect glass balls, sort of perfect paperweights with miniature, very, very bright things inside them, which you can
Twists
magnify.
Of smoke.
Yes. And I do, in fact, collect glass paperweights. I've never collected anything, but they seem such a perfect image for so much of what I care about, the sort of the brilliance and the weight and the condensed feeling there is to them. There is a sense, there's something very good about getting to be 60 and knowing, A, exactly what you want to do, and B, still being able to do it. It's just that time is rather short and compression is of the essence.
I've been speaking to A.S. Byatt about the book The Gin in the Nightingale's Eye, Five Fairy Stories, published by Random House. Thank you for joining me. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.